Hey y'all, my name's Joe. I'm an alcoholic and drug addict. And I'm an Al-Anon, I'm an ACOA, I'm a trauma survivor, and other stuff. And I tell you that because it's important that you hear that my connection to a power greater than me has allowed me to deal with all these other things and not let those affect my behavior today, which is pretty kick-ass. My sobriety date is August 5th of 1991. I've got 29 years of sobriety, and more importantly, I have 29 years of recovery. So, the beginning of my story, I always like to invite you to join me in this moment. Mainly, I like to do this because it helps me calm down. So we're all going to take 3 deep, long, delicious breaths together so that we can all be in this place together for the next hour. So I'm going to start y'all off. So go ahead and take a deep breath in. Hold it for a second and then blow it out your mouth like you're blowing out a straw. Slowly and completely. Take another deep breath in. Feel your lungs expand, your shoulders drop from your ears, and then blow it out your mouth like you're blowing out a straw. Feel your butt in your chair or your bed or wherever. Feel the solidity of the ground that you're on. Now take another deep breath in. Feel that oxygen go through all the parts of your body. Hold it and then blow it out your mouth slowly and completely. Feel your shoulders drop. Feel that blood in your body. And be here with me. Hi. Okay, I'm here now. So, the events in my life are important, but it's how I practice the 12 steps of recovery on those events. That's why I'm here. I'm here to talk to y'all about that. Unlike my delicate flower of a husband, my past is not as entertaining. It was kind of dark, and so I'm going to share about it in terms of the 4th step, because I think it's important. Everything in my childhood revolved around drinking. I was born to 2 loving parents, soon to get divorced and switch partners with their bridge partners. And so I had 4 loving parents, very, very sick. They were active alcoholics, and they were in their early 30s in the mid 60s, and they were partying. I was the 2nd kid, and they had a lot of parties. And so most of the other kids back in the 60s, like when grown-ups had parties, they shoved all the fairly self-sustaining kids in the back room while they partied in the living room. And I was the youngest of all those kids in the group. So I got to hang with the adults. And that was when I started drinking. My drinking career started as soon as I could pull myself up to the coffee table and reach. And I began drinking. And everyone back then thought it was awesome. They thought it was funny. They thought it was cute. And I have a very fierce allergy to alcohol. So my body did not react like normal people's as a child, and I craved more. And that was what I did. Once again, my parents loved me very much, but their disease took first place. There was neglect from my mom, because she was either drinking, drunk, or recovering from a hangover. And my, like I say, my parents got divorced when I was young. So my dad and my stepmom got married when I was 5. And then my mom and my stepmom's husband, John, got married when I was around 5. They just switched partners. And that was when the real dysfunction started. My stepdad was a blackout drinker and from the get-go. And so I learned really quickly that drinking was an everyday thing, and I didn't understand why I couldn't participate. And so I had my first real blackout that I remember at 8. I was at a party at my parents' cousin's house, and I called him my uncle. It was a New Year's Eve party, and he said, and I was sneaking drinks, you know, as much as I could, but he said, "Why don't you come on over here? And here's a juice glass, about 8-ounce glass." And he said, "I think you need to have one of these for every year you've been alive." And I said, "Yes, I agree." And so he poured cold duck in that glass, and I downed them, one right after the next. And believe it or not, at 8 years old, I already had a pretty big tolerance. I had a pretty high tolerance. So I did not get alcohol poisoning. I continued on partying, and then sooner or later stumbled into the living room where no one goes, right? The one that has the protected couch. And I must have fallen, passed out on the couch, because I remember waking up on the floor, and apparently I had fallen off of the couch and knocked over the coffee table. And there were all these concerned faces looking over me. And I remember, as sick as I probably was physically, I remember thinking, this is how I want to feel for the rest of my life. This is it. At 8 years old. And that's what I continued to do. That's what I pursued. Everything else was secondary. So the ritual was, get up in the morning hungover. Mom would bring me orange juice and aspirin and coffee, and I would drink it and go to school and get through school the best I could, and then come home and she would have wine and cheese, and then the margaritas would happen, and then I would do my homework, and then I'd have to do my homework on the bus the next day because I was so drunk I couldn't read it. And that's kind of how it went. And so, and I started taking aspirin and Midol to get a buzz to help with the hangovers. I began abusing those then. So life was chaotic. There was a lot of screaming and fighting. There was a lot of threats of violence. And it was scary, but it was all I knew. I just assumed everybody lived that way. So there was emotional and sexual abuse. And of course, the sexual abuse was from my stepdad. And I like to talk about this in terms of the fourth step, because I learned to get my self-esteem, my emotional security, my physical security, and my ambitions from helping my mom. Like, she would pass out, and I would, you know, I would have to keep her going so I could get dinner. Her and my stepdad would have a fight, and I would run back and forth and be the referee, because I knew if I didn't keep everybody happy, I might not get fed, you know. But I got a huge sense of power from that. I learned my relationship to men, what I thought at the time my value was in my body. At 13, from 13 to 17, I began to attract my stepdad's attention. And I used that as a power, as a tool. Once again, I got self-esteem, emotional security. When he was happy, mom was happy, and he left her alone. Great sense of power in that. And as a child, my parents are my gods, right? So we do what we can to keep the gods happy. And that's where the PTSD came in. So I drank, I moved from drinking for fun when I was eight to drinking for necessity when I was a teenager. I had to blot out that pain. And I began sleeping in different places around the house because that way, if my stepdad got too drunk, he couldn't find me, right? But then sometimes I would miss the mark and I would get too drunk and I'd forget to move or I'd pass out where I was. And so that was my life. That was, it was this constant hamster wheel until I was 17. And once again, my parents loved me to pieces the best they could. And I have forgiveness in my heart today. And that's because I've worked the fuck out of these steps. So, and that's why I have notes, because I drank so much as a kid, I have no memory. So, so today, I'm a grown up woman and they're no longer my gods. And I get to choose how I respond to present day stimulus. And it's through practicing these steps that I've been able to stay present and not have those PTSD responses when I smell certain things or I hear certain noises. It still comes, but it doesn't take me down the rabbit hole anymore. I know what's happening when I have a panic attack, and I can breathe through it. It doesn't rule my life today. So my mom was mentally and spiritually sick and physically sick. I became her friend. I became her savior. I was her perfect gift from God. And my job was there. I was to keep her happy. And that was my job. And keep her alive. And so the delusion was that I can and must control my external circumstances so that I'm okay. My stepdad, I learned that the delusion was I had to control my external circumstances so that I'll be okay. Well, I was in fight or flight most of the time, biochemically challenged. I found speed in high school, which really helped with the drinking. Thank you to my connection. And I was really learning how to be God. That's what I was learning through all these experiences, that I was in control and that I had to keep track of everything. Well, then I turned 17 and it was time for me to leave home. And I was terrified something was going to happen to my mom because I knew what my stepdad was capable of. But I knew I couldn't stay there. On some sort of deep medulla level, I knew I had to get the hell out. So I was born in Austin, moved to Houston when everybody got remarried, and then moved back to Austin at 17 to go to school at UT. And I always knew in my heart of hearts that something bad was going to happen when I left home. My mom had written suicide notes, and she kept them in a place that she let us all know where they were in case things went bad and she needed to check out. I was really nervous about it, but I left home, started partying like a normal person in college, and nothing happened. And I was okay, and she was okay, and I just stopped calling home. When I was 25, it took 7 years, I got the call that she was dead, and my stepdad was indicted for her murder, and it was my fault, and I knew it was my fault. So being the good codependent now and on that I am, I jumped into action, got the funeral planned, bailed him out of jail, innocent until proven guilty. I was hugely strung out on speed at the time, and 2 years of litigation later, shit went down. The charges were dropped because it looked like she had committed suicide. But all signs pointed to my stepdad. So I made a decision that I will never know what happened that night, and it's not for me to know. All I know is if I hadn't left, she wouldn't be dead. And so that really started my downward spiral. So what did I do? I got married. Like you do. Poor guy. And lots of promiscuity. Drinking started really getting out of control. And another Al-Anon symptom of mine was my mom was caring for my grandmother. Well, I went on ahead and took over and became her power of attorney at 25. So I began taking care of my grandmother. So that's what it was like. What happened? What happened was taking care of my grandmother. She was living with me and my husband. The year before my mom died, her husband of 60 some odd years had passed. And here she was, left in my care, crazy young alcoholic woman, losing her mind. And I say I took care of my grandmother. I would go to work until Thursday, and then I had to go blow off steam. So I would be gone on benders from Thursday to Sunday. And I always come home remorseful, and my husband was the good Al-Anon, and he wielded that power, you know. You should be ashamed. I know, I'll never do it again. And just constant. So my last drunk, it was another Thursday through Sunday debacle, but I didn't come home on Sunday night. I didn't come home. And my husband finally tracked me down and called this dude. And I was in the bitter morass of self-pity for being found in another man's bed. And so my husband said, you need to come home. I have some decisions to make, and so do you. And I was like, oh, fuck, he's really serious this time. So got home, and I'm pacing around, and my grandmother was just beside herself. And I think that was the first time I recognized I was hurting someone else with my drinking. Fuck my husband. You'd drink if you had a husband like him, too. But my grandmother. I realized, she was like, baby, where were you? And here's an 89-year-old woman dependent on me for her financial needs. And I wasn't there for days. And I was like, the only thing she understood was I was at a dance. And the dance just lasted a long time. So I'm pacing around. I'm like, shit, I got to do something. Of course, I called into work because I was so fucking hungover. And I found a pamphlet from a woman. A friend of mine was, she was in a domestic abuse relationship. And she had left a pamphlet at my house from AWARE, Austin Women's Education and Rehabilitation something. And there was a phone number in it for if you have drinking problems. And I thought, okay, well, maybe this is it, you know. And I'm trying to get my wits about me, and I made the phone call, finally got the nerve to make the phone call. And on the other end, I hear, Popeye's Fried Chicken, can I help you? And I hung up the phone. I was like, what the fuck? I finally reach a point, I want help. Okay, Joe, you're still drunk. You just dialed the wrong number. You just need to get your shit together and dial the right number. So another hour of pacing. I dial the number, I get Popeye's Fried Chicken, can I help you? I'm like, motherfucker. So I hang up the phone, I'm like, what the hell? And so I'm pacing around, and I was always really an agnostic with no experience with a power greater than me, because I was the great and powerful Oz. After all, my mom told me your initials are JC for a reason. Just saying. But I stopped and I was like, all right, I don't know what to do. First time in my life, I don't know what to do. And I had my first spiritual awakening. This was back before computers and whatnot. Or before I had a computer. And it dawned on me, why don't you look in the phone book? I can look in the phone book. So I did. And they had transposed two of the goddamn numbers on that pamphlet. And I really was calling Popeye's Fried Chicken. So I ended up finally calling AWARE, and they got me into outpatient treatment, and I really needed to get my husband off my back. And I go to treatment and they tell me, you're going to have to go to 2 AA meetings a week. And I was like, fine, whatever I need to do, I just need therapy. You people don't understand. I come from a fucked up background. I mean, my intake was 11 pages front and back, narrow ruled. I had a lot to say about everything that had ever happened to me. A lot of excuses, but no real reasons. So treatment was wonderful. I learned that I was not the only one with abuse problems. There were a lot of people in this world that were dealing with the same issues I was. And they were being successful at it. I think the main thing I got from treatment was an introduction to AA. I began going to AA, and my first meeting, of course, I made my husband go, because fuck that dude. And I saw a friend of mine in there, a drinking buddy named Kim, and she had 9 months. I was like, motherfucker, Kim's in here? She's much worse than me. This might work for me. That was my first little bit of identification. Well, after the meeting, she came up to me and she's like, oh, honey, I'm so glad you're here because you're so much worse than me. And I was like, what? So anyway, I told my husband, you don't have to come with me anymore. Kim's here. I got this. So I started going to AA and I began hearing my story. And I got a sponsor, bless her heart. My first sponsor was a very sweet woman. She loved me so much. And she didn't teach me a goddamn thing. She had me write my life story. And then I went to her apartment and she had me read it to her. And then she lit this stuff that smelled like pot to me. But I wasn't a big pothead. I was into speed. I had to control shit. So I'm like, well, whatever this is fine. And she was waving it around. I know now that was smudging. And then she told me we were going to burn it. We're just going to burn that and you don't ever have to worry about that again. I was like, okay. So we burned it and I went home and was still really fucking pissed and really scared and not understanding what these people in the meetings were talking about anymore because I was not getting any fucking promises. Well, there was a friend of mine that went to treatment with me. And she said, oh, damn, you should have my sponsor. She gives me assignments out of the big book. And I'm like, ooh, I'm a big academic. I want assignments. So I got Vera as my sponsor. And Vera did not love me. Vera taught me how to work the steps out of the big book. And for that, I'm eternally grateful. Saved my life. Let me make sure I'm not missing anything. Still married at this time, right? So my first run through the steps was fast. Vera had me go through the steps pretty fast. We didn't spend a whole lot of time on 1, 2, and 3. She did not want to hear all my theories on how there's not a God. but she said, let's just get you right in this 4-step. And I thought, okay, great. Now is the time I get to, tell someone all these terrible things that happened to me. I was just like, here's my victim hat. Da, 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 da. Not understanding that I was trying to convince myself that I had to drink. I could not imagine life without alcohol. But up to this point, I was about 6 months sober. And how the hell that happened, I had no idea. I was just going to meetings. And it was like I was being carried. And I wasn't even trying not to drink. It just didn't occur to me. Which was, I mean, since I'm free, that's the first time in my life that it ever occurred to me. So, going to meetings, did my 4-step. She had me do it with Pat. And Pat just had me fill out these sheets, right? And I did my 4-step in 30 minutes. I was ready to write another thesis, you know? Fucking 30 minutes. I checked some boxes, self-esteem, personal relations, whatever. And I was done. I'm like, okay, we'll go with this now. But when I get to that 5th step, boy, we're really going to rip everybody a new asshole. Well, I got to the 5th step and Vera listened for patterns and she was writing stuff down as I was reading this. And she helped me see my patterns, my way overdeveloped security instinct, and how that pretty much covered up everything, and how I was getting my self-esteem from the world and its people. And as long as I was doing that, I was always in threat of relapse, because the world and its people are often quite wrong, and they're often quite sick. She showed me where the sick man prayer was in the big book. And I started saying that for my mom and for my stepdad. And my heart began to open. And that victim hat went away. And I finally had some agency in my life, real agency. So then we got done with the fifth step, and she said, okay, so now you need to go home and spend an hour quiet and, you know, review the first five proposals and do all that, you know, step 5.5 worship. I'm like, fine, whatever. I went home and was so full of energy, I vacuumed my whole goddamn house and just went on with my day. And 2 or 3 days later, I began to get restless, irritable, and discontent. And I called up Vera, and I'm like, yeah, this isn't working for me. See, I told you, I'm different. And she said, well, so the other day after your fifth, did you go home and sit quietly for an hour and review the first five proposals like I told you to? Yes. Yes, I did. Used to lie a lot. And she's like, well, I don't know what to tell you then, because if you did what I said, then things should be shifting for you. And I was like, okay. And I hung up the phone and I thought, oh my fucking God, I've just lied to my sponsor. And I heard in meetings, if you lie to your sponsor, you're going to get drunk. So another hour of pacing, and I called her up and I'm like, Vera, I lied to you. I did not do that sitting in the dark. You know, I didn't do all that. And she just laughed, that hideous laugh that she always laughed. And she's like, well, you've just done your first amends. I was like, excuse me? And she's like, yeah, you made amends promptly. You told on yourself. How's that feel? Feels pretty damn good. She's like, yeah, now go fucking do what I told you to do. So I did. And so then I started doing my amends. And that was hugely transformative for me. Well, then about 3 years into my recovery, I ran into the Joe and Charlie Big Book Study. And they actually came to Austin in 94. And it was mind-blowing. It opened the big book up for me like nothing ever had. And that was really the beginning of my recovery. I started practicing the principles in all of my affairs, and I knew what the principles were. I started sponsoring other women who had the same issues I did, who had PTSD, who were adult children of alcoholics. And I was terrified of sponsorship, because what did it remind you of? Right? Me having to save my mom again. I had to go save these women again. And it pushed that button in me, and it scared the fuck out of me. And Vera said, okay, you're afraid. You got to do it anyway, because they aren't your mom, and they're dying anyway. And you can't hurt them. And if you don't help them, at least you'll stay sober. Like, oh, okay. So I began sponsoring. And what that did was, proper use of vanity got me looking at my shit. How do I work this program? How can I explain how I work this program? I started listening to that Joe and Charlie thing over and over and over and over. And that's what shapes the program for me today. I spend a lot of time in recovery just not hurting. And then God put people in my life like Chris and Kim, my friend Kim. I had twin girls in 97, sober mom. I got divorced in 2000, sober single mom. I was single for 6 years, looking at my three-year-olds and thinking, I was drinking by then. Looking at my eight-year-olds, imagining them in a blackout. That was startling. looking at my 13 to 17 year olds, healing from my trauma with the steps, inviting a power greater than myself in that solves my problem today. I don't think you can work this program the way it's outlined in the book and not just stay sober, but your fucking life will explode. And you better keep up, because it gets bigger and cooler and bigger and cooler. Now, one of the greatest joys I have is sponsorship. I still don't want to. And I think one of my sponsees is on in the meeting today. But yes, when I get phone calls from sponsees, I still go, oh man. But I answer the call. And when I do, whoa, my heart opens and I get to experience joy again. I forget what joy feels like. When I take a new person through steps 1, 2, and 3, and we talk about the fact that you don't need to describe your higher power to me. Let's talk about what it feels like. Let's talk about when you talk to me about this step, whatever step, and you do your research and you do your reading and you follow what the textbook says, how do you feel after that? Do you want a drink? No. That right there is a miracle, but there's more. When I go through step 4 and I help someone see how simple it is, and it's not a forum to blame others. It's not a forum to blame yourself. The first and second columns, rip them a new asshole. Do it. Call them every fucking name. I want to hear it. I want you to download that shit, because you're going to do it anyway. But let's throw it in the spiritual structure of the steps. And when you get too deep in it, I'm going to pull your ass out and say, now let's look at the third column. How is your self-esteem affected by that motherfucker? How is your security affected by that motherfucker who, by the way, isn't in the room? My stepdad's dead today. He's not doing that to me anymore. It was pointed out in treatment that I was doing it to me every day. I had that resentment. What he did is over. I was using it as a reason to get loaded, to check out. But I was doing that. That's why I say now I have agency in my life. I have true power. I'm not dependent. I get to choose what I do today. Connection with that power greater than me, which the book says is in me. Hello. So I always have access to it. Connection with that power puts me in alignment with the universe. So intuitive thoughts just come. And situations that used to baffle me, I know how to handle today. But there's work to do before that shit. For me, steps 6 and 7 are pivotal. If I do an inventory and I don't get to step 6, I've wasted my fucking time. And if I have a sponsee who does an inventory and hasn't tried at least to get to step 6, they've wasted my fucking time. Or they've asked for my help with it. And I get to help them see the opposites of those character defects they came up with in the 5th column of their inventory. What does it look like when you're unselfish, honest, courageous, considerate, realistic? Guess what? You're not doing it to be nice. Not doing it to be a good girl or a good boy. You're doing it to save your life and have a life worth saving. So to get to experience those phone calls when a gal will call me up and go, Joe, okay, we talked about this thing. I had my step 6 card. Right before I went in, I read my step 6. I went and did the thing. And when I was done, it fucking kicked ass. I felt great. I've been scared of this thing for years. And I went in and I did it, and I felt great. That's freedom. Freedom from fear. I don't have to worry about what's going to happen anymore. I have tools. And when I connect to this power and I get in alignment with it, and I don't care what it is, to me it's like air. That's why I like the breathing thing, right? It's always there. But when I think about it, conscious contact, it's conscious and deliberate. I'm not running the show, but I have the ability to connect so that I can run the show. And when things don't go my way, that's all right. Because I have tools. 10, 11, and 12. I was in a meeting one time and this girl goes, she was new in recovery and she's like, did you people realize if you really do what this book says, what your life could look like? I was like, boom, she got it. You know, this is an instruction book. When it says I bring the vision of God's will for me into all of my activities, guess what? Everything you do is an activity. Everything. When I pick up my phone, what's the vision of God's will for me? Unselfish, honest, courageous, considerate, realistic, God-seeking. Before I go to Target, the vision of God's will for me before I go shopping. That's a biggie for me. You know, booze and drugs was not my only issue. Sometimes I get material things and try and shove them in that spiritual hole and it don't work. But I still try. So getting that vision before I go into my activity, participating in that activity, doing a little 30, 60 second review when I'm done in the car. How'd that go? What did I do well? What did I impulse buy? Keep my receipt for 3 days. That's my rule. When I have to go have an uncomfortable conversation with someone, I can't just pray to God that it's going to go well and then go have a conversation. I have to get in alignment with that power, and I can tell. It's a physical thing for me. I can tell when I'm in alignment with it. Drinking's not my problem today. It's disconnection is my problem. And at any moment, I have the opportunity to reconnect. I'm no longer ignorant, and guess what? Neither are you. You have the ability to respond today. Responsibility. I know, it's so fucking hokey. But that's how I have to remember things, because, you know, I drink a lot. The conscious contact, I've never been a Christian. I've never really been, I've never experienced all that stuff. Booze and drugs were my higher powers when I got in here. To me, it's an experiential thing. It's deliberate. It's conscious. I have to think about it. I have to do it. I have to remember it's there. Every activity, everything I do can be imbued with that sense, that connection. And when I do, talk about big, cool life. It's just such, alcohol's a subtle foe, drugs are a subtle foe, malady is a subtle foe, so is recovery, so is spiritual connection. It's a subtle shift. And life, I'm not a slave to my dis-ease in the world anymore. I have ease in this world. And of course, 12, practicing the principles in all of my affairs, knowing what the principles are, and having had a spiritual awakening. Every experience I have can be spiritual. So I can have spiritual fucking awakenings all goddamn day long if I want to. What am I seeking? It's a beautiful way to live. It's not just about being clean, people. It's about wanting the life that you have. And having a life that you want. So today, I don't get my self-esteem through my body. I don't get my self-esteem through helping people, enabling people. I get my self-esteem, my personal relations, all those third column things, through direction of the universe and action based on that direction. Period. Simple. And when I do that, the results are incredible. So anyway, so now we're going to do the three breath thing again, because I think I'm close to time. Am I? Okay. Let's do three breaths again, because that's my favorite part. Okay. All that hoo-ha, and I know I've left out a whole lot of crap. That's always the way it goes. Okay, so we're going to breathe out. Feel your body in your chair. Get loosey-goosey in your chair. And then take a deep, delicious breath in. Hold it for a second. And then blow it out your mouth like you're blowing out a straw. Take another deep breath in. Go slow. Enjoy. Hold it for a sec and then blow it out your mouth slowly and completely. Shoulders fall from your ears. Feel the weight of your body in your chair. Now take another deep breath in. Fill up all the way. Hold it. And then blow it out your mouth slowly and completely. You feel that oxygen in your hands, your feet, your toes, your fingers. Feel the blood pumping in your body, warm. Breathing normally. There's space. There's time. There's freedom. There's joy. There is no lack in the present moment. Nothing to fill. Thank you for occupying that space for me. And thank you so much for my life.
That was awesome, Joe.
Thank you so much, Joe.
Thank you for having me.
It was really
give me hope.
Thanks, Joe.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.